Some of you have been here before, at least for us, as we enter. It's been 6 years since we've been here, and it takes a little adjusting to a new community. You meet all these friendly people at the table, your children disappear, and you sleep in a different bed. The language is a little different. You have to sort of gear into that and the worship life, and we become a community. For me, it's a crossroads. That's what I like about it. I like meeting the people. Sometimes it feels tiring because you get up in the morning and all day goes. You're going to read that chapter or whatever in a book, and all of a sudden it's 10 o'clock at night. I don't know if that fits for you, but that fits for me. I haven't started yet. You would never guess who my wife is. I didn't figure it mounted to the tape. I'm Gary Peterson. Obviously, this is Linda Peterson then. And I'm supposed to notify Bertha on the tape if I'm going to start. Now I have to decide if we really want to start. Do you want to start, Linda? Okay, Bertha, we'll start up this tape here. I suppose from the questions I've already received, people like to know a little bit about us, and we have this little bit of time and trying to make some decisions on how to use that time. I've been a pastor for 14 years in California before we went overseas, and we were 3 years out of the country in an urban ministry in Lima, Peru. We've just returned, so we've had that amount of time outside the country, which is an interesting experience to return and go through some of the culture shock, to go to the grocery store, you know, see those little lines on the boxes and try to figure out the price, and have your children standing there really curious over a variety of differences that are striking to us. Because we've been in Peru, we want to share a little bit from our perspective how we entered and how we experience this particular South American country. But because I know a variety of people have also been out of the country and lived outside the United States and bring a variety of experience and questions, in a little bit, if you can think about it for a moment, I'm going to ask you some questions and then I'll put them on the board. Questions such as, why are you here? What do you hope to learn? Those kind of questions. We really do have a short amount of time. Some of you will see all of these slides. We're going to use about 40 of them, or 45 at the most. We don't have time for a slide presentation, nor do I want that. I found that having sat through other people's slide presentations, as interesting as they are, they sure mean a lot more to the person who took the picture. And for me, they're a window. And that's how we'd like to use it today, as a window to some of the experiences and reality that we can talk about. You can see, you can experience, and Latin America is a very close neighbor of ours. So, beginning with that particular thought, you can consider what it is that you have as a question, what maybe brought you here today. Now, are there some of those I can stick on this board over here? I know how to handle this mic here. You want to do that?
But I need some.
Right, we need to know what you're thinking about. Okay?
I'd like to know what's happening politically.
Okay, what's going on politically in Peru? Having returned, we find it really difficult to find out what's going on in Peru. There's very little news about South America here. Much more on Central America. So we'll refer to that. Okay?
Economic influence of the United States on Peru's economy.
Okay. Economic influence of the United States on Peru's economy. And obviously we're not experts in all of this, but certainly living there as citizens of the United States and not really blending in. I just didn't quite ever make it. To blend in, I was often thought of as either a German or the United States. And so I become an ambassador in that. And so these questions are important too. Okay, we've got the economic and the political. What else?
The nature of the guerrilla movement.
Okay, the guerrilla or the terrorist groups that are in Peru. We'll come to that. The rich and poor. This is contrast is our theme, isn't it? I think Peru does real well with that. And
I have an ongoing interest in non-Western Christianity. So
and the church.
I'm always curious to find out about actual situations.
What she said was she has an interest in non-Western Christianity, and what we can do and what we have a strong interest in is the church in Peru and how that particular church in reality brings to them their perspective, some perspectives that I think are helpful to us in the United States of the same gospel we have, the same scriptures and understanding of God. Okay. Is overpopulation?
Yeah.
Is Peru an overpopulated country?
Yeah.
Okay. So we can talk about population and poverty both as they impact each other. Okay, any more? Now what I can do is share with you some of my questions as a way to help you focus on the slides that I've selected for today. And then as I share those slides with you, I'll make comments about what we have here. If you discover you have, you know, it jogs you a little more, then later we'll take the Indian time to address more specific questions, and hopefully we'll have some answers to that. When I first picked the slides, my goal was, I said, as a window. But I also meant by that to introduce you to some people. Some don't have people in the pictures. It'll be a country. But that's the world that they know, that you might hear some of the needs and concerns of Latin America and come to understand what they call the realidad, the reality. Now, secondly, with that understanding of reality, their worldview, if you will, comes an understanding of the scriptures, which was referred to. We bring that context to our reading of the scriptures, and so do they. So as you look at the slides, I'll spend a little more time on this later in the week, but if you lived in that world, that was your life, that was your reality, how would you read the scriptures? Because we do bring something to the scriptures as we read them. Thirdly, that you might see the Peruvians not as foreigners, but as brothers and sisters in Christ. Now, as I said before, when I was there, or we were there, we were foreigners, and certainly stood out in our neighborhood and with the people we worked. But at the same time, our goal was to break down that difference that was a difference of birth and to relate with each other as human beings. And that is one of my goals in sharing this with you. To increase our awareness of poverty and the role of the church, the role of God with marginalized people. Because our project with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Peru is to work with marginalized people. If we were to seek out the middle class and relate to them, they'd fire us right away. But is to relate with people who are marginalized, and we can respond to some definitions of that too. You should note that foreign missions has changed. As some of us grew up, and I had a missionary pastor who had been to India, and I'm sure some of you had other contacts with missionaries. One of the words today is holistic. How can we come as outsiders into their world and relate to all the aspects of their life? Not coming, as sometimes has been caricatured, of missionaries who walk down and they have in their suitcase God. They kind of, here's God, here's how we do the liturgy, The Columbian Lutheran Church, I noticed, even has a green worship book. So that sometimes we bring a lot of baggage with us, and one of those is not God, but rather to discover God and His Spirit, or how God is already active in the life of the people. We have a gospel mandate, and it's not just to save, but it's to love. And those are struggles that we share. Now, I share those questions because those are how we entered into the Peruvian reality. And from that vantage point, we can share some other things with you. Okay, I think that's probably enough. I'm going to do really great, aren't I? I feel wired here. Why don't I just sit down? I share the map because I'm learning that many of us really don't even know where Peru is. So we begin in a variety of awarenesses of the country. It's the third largest country in Latin America. It's the green one over here. And traditionally, this was Upper Peru. This is where the richest gold mine in the world was discovered. So when the Spaniards came, they took the gold here, and they took it out right here, Lima. And they sent it back to Spain. So the history that Peru brings is first to be the number one port for the Spaniards, who arrived with Pizarro in Lima, where they claimed the city and founded it in 1532. Remembering for a moment our own history, founded, or at least we talk about Columbus with 1492. So a concern that's taking place in this part of the world, which became all Spanish-speaking except for the large one there, which is Portuguese in Brazil, they're talking about the 5th century, about 1992, 500 years of a dominated imposed culture. And this, if you find articles, and if you have an interest in this part of the world, you'll discover there'll be more and more articles related to that. Okay, here is Lima. Here's the large Amazon that begins here in the mountains. Iquitos and some of the other tourist places are related to that. The mountains here, the Andes, are so high that it makes this part down here, down to Arica in Chile, the driest desert in the world. So you'll begin to think about Lima as a coastal city, but a city that's at the northern end of the driest desert in the world. Most of us who come as tourists enter this world. We enter to see the history related to the Inca. That's the Quechua people who called their leader the Inca. And they have a marvelous history, and we're not going to go into that today, but it brings people from all over the world. Lots of Europeans, much more percentage-wise Europeans than North Americans, who come to learn about the mystique of these people. There's my favorite slide that hasn't fallen down yet. Okay, my degree and bachelor's is in mechanical engineering, so I had a real thrill to see how they put rocks together. They wonder how they did it. Let me back up and see if I can get that other slide to fall down. Ah, I still can't do that. This particular discovery, I think, has done a lot for tourism. It's number one tourist attraction, obviously, in Peru. And I'm showing these slides because that's what brought most of our visitors to see us. They didn't want to come and see urban ministry in a city of 7 million people as much as they were interested in this particular site, and majestic as it is. This is Sacsayhuaman in Cusco, which was the imperial city of the Incas. And those are my kids. Again, to note a very area of many earthquakes, how they built, connecting everything together so that they're still there. And this would have been a time from 1300s, 1400s that this was done. They don't know. They've got a lot of theories. I think I just figured this out. This and that last picture are Lake Titicaca, the highest navigable lake in the world, the largest. It goes from Peru to Bolivia. And these people who live there in these floating islands and make their boats out of these reeds were used by Thor Heyerdahl. Those of you of Norwegian background remember the stories of the 50s, how he put together that boat then to show how these people maybe arrived in this part of the world from Polynesia. This slide is from the mountain area of the Andes, but taken in Bolivia, and this is Tarabuco, a city that I've included because of particularly this helmet that the man is wearing. We come as tourists, we just love the way the materials and the fabrics, how the people dress, we're so interested. One of the embarrassing things we tourists do is we walk up and we just take pictures. Can you imagine somebody just walking up, taking your picture, doesn't even ask? Happens all the time. So I'm sneaky as best I can be, but this particular hat is how the Spaniards were dressing when they came. Note in your mind, if you're really going to think about the difference between Latin America and the United States, which have very different histories, often it was only men who went to South America exploring for gold. Gustavo Gutierrez, one of the theologians in Peru, has just written a book. Is it God or gold of the Indies that these people came for? And so what's happening is we're aware that they came with their religion, but they were looking for gold. This has carried over into the people, that part of the history, and how they dress. This is Nazca. The Nazca lines have been made famous by some books and movies, wondering who were some of these early people. Were they even from outer space? Where do these lines come from? And you can see by the desert how desert it is. It's nothing there. Along that dry coast, of course, we had the history of the guano. An important economic part of Peruvian history and Chilean. This is my son fishing, because along with the guano, there was a rich amount of fish or abundance, and that, of course, has been depleted in recent years, too. The people, then, who live in the mountains, who carry on the traditions of their fathers and mothers, who are part of a workforce which includes everyone in the family, is an important part of noting in the Peruvian history. But now we finish as tourists and we go back to Lima. Oh, great. One of the problems of sometimes having your slides developed in South America is how they're mounted. Let's see if we can get that one to behave. Still not going to behave. Okay, that particular slide is not that important. We enter into the reality, and that last slide was a large billboard in Lima that talks about human rights, which was put up a couple years ago because of the need for human rights in Peru. Many people have been killed. Last year, there were more disappeared people in Peru than there were anywhere in the world. It was anywhere. There's a problem not only in terms of, as referred to earlier, of terrorism, but the military brings its own terror on the people, which causes a lack of confidence in the government. And you add all of these political ramifications to this, which is the cocaine explosion. cocaine. We are related that way to Peru. Someone asked about how does the United States get into Peru. Last I heard, there were 78 agents of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, in the Huallaga Valley, which is the richest coca-growing valley in the world. This impacts upon Lima as well. People have been leaving Lima to, in fact, go up and work in that area. Now, we can maybe come back to that one a little later, because it's very important how drug is related. Drugs are related into the culture of the people, and also how the United States is part of that. This is a picture of poverty. A woman who probably lives most of her life there on the streets with her child, probably has cooked something and then sold that for lunch to those around her. This is a kind of work. The poor believe a myth, and it comes up frequently enough, that the poor are lazy. It's hard to understand that as an outsider, to come in and hear these people say, but, well, you know, the poor, we're lazy. We see them working hard from morning until night. We see the children, in this case, caring for the ones younger than them, because everyone in the family is working to survive. In 1988, Peru had about 2,000% inflation. That is unfathomable in our understanding of inflation. 10% is overwhelming for us in the United States. But 2,000% is chaos. This is what a shanty town is, a pueblo joven, as they call it, a young town. This particular is an old slide, and it's an older pueblo joven. They begin with the grass mats, not quite in that way usually, but then they work up to get four walls, and you can see the landscape, dry. There's no water, there's no electricity, there's no sewage. But for the reasons of violence, the desire for education for their children, the desire for health, what they consider to be human rights, they come to Lima, the capital of their country, making it a very unusual capital. First, it was the port which the gold was exported from. Now it becomes, of course, the major place to import to help keep this population alive. Usually, invaded land is on government land. There's been 30 to 40 years of history of these invasions. There's been people killed, lots of marching, but it becomes a population is impacted. I mean, they just reach such a density that they spill over. And people, sometimes very organized, go off and take a plot of land, maybe up to 2,000 to 5,000 people, and they go in, they have it kind of all marked off and figure out where to place their estera, it's called, their mats. I include this because every hour, I think they say, the health organization, one Peruvian child dies between the ages of 0 and 5. I've also heard that 1 out of 3 Peruvian children before the age of 5 dies. This is the recipe for diarrhea, so that the dehydration becomes a killer, as well as malnutrition, which results in tuberculosis. So that's 4 cups of water and 10 teaspoons of sugar, a tablespoon and a half of salt, and then you boil that for 5 minutes. Where I spent my time working was in a pueblo joven to the north of Lima, and this is the greatest theologian in our congregation. Her name is Consuelo, and she is also the best cook. And so the other ladies, which was part of our congregational work, was to have a soup kitchen in order that together they could buy things, saving a little bit of money by shopping that way together, cook together, and then feed their children and themselves. This little building you see covered with a grass mat, this is adobe that's been painted and belonged to a little widow. and she was pleased that the church could use her building. This is the community, people in line to receive probably that day some sugar and maybe some cooking oil. When you have large percent of inflation, you have shortages because, you know, tomorrow if you hold on to it, you're going to be able to sell it for a lot more. So as the time became real tense, the government would provide a relief for the pressure cooker, and that is to provide them with some of the basics of living. This is what a market looks like. So you can buy it nice and fresh. Nothing comes wrapped in plastic. This is the patron saint of the market as the people march around with her. This is Ugo, who I worked with, acting as pastor and, as you can see, performing a baptism there. Those of you with experience in Latin America might guess this one. Very important anniversary. She turned 15 years old. And for a young lady, that's a very special day. So even the poor, I was just shocked to know they could go out and buy new clothes for her and even some shoes. This is Ugo and his wife Carmen. Both very effective workers, have chosen to work with the poor, receive no salary or income for that, but at the same time are working in other areas, have two boys, so that their time is limited as well. This was a confirmation. This happened earlier this year. We were able to buy a building kind of across the street from where we were. And so we were having the dedication that day. You can see there's lots of kids. Do you remember, Linda, the statistics of the how much the population is below the age of, what, 25 or so? This enormous percent of the people are young. Ugo had me get dressed up that day, so I wore a stole because this was a special day to bless the building. He said I better look my best. I don't know what it amounted to, but the lady receiving the chalice was the lady that we used her building. And she gave a wonderful sermon that day to talk about the seeds. And it was good. I'd never heard her give that kind of a talk before, which goes to show that every one of us has it in us. I'm going to show real quickly some slides just on the culture. Well, you can see, you know, how it is. It's dry. They throw their dishwater and so forth into the street. They do have electricity in this area. They don't have water or sewage. And I am, in this case, they want to have a fundraiser because with that inflation in Peru, you have to provide all of the things you need for school. So they needed to have a fundraiser to make money for paper and pencils and stuff like that. So they wanted a yunza, and that's a mountain tradition, which is to decorate a tree. So the ladies bought a tree and had me haul it in there. Obviously, I'm the rich gringo. I have the car, the only car there. This is the men sticking that tree in the ground. And one of the branches had to cut off, so the boys thought they might try their own, see what kind of presents they might get. Because you decorate the tree with goodies. And another missioner, Margaret, who's from Canada, who's president of the mission there, and myself were the padrinos, the godparents. That meant we went out and bought fruit and pencils and erasers and stuff. And you decorate the tree, and then you dance around the tree. And as part of that dancing, you stop now and then. Here's Linda. She has a machete, and she's taking a whack at the tree. Might be a possible fundraiser for your congregation. We started at 12 o'clock, and they finally cut the tree down at 9:30 at night. So there's no hurry. The music's on and you're dancing, having a good time when the ladies were selling ceviche that day. And that's going considered one of the best dishes you can get in Peru. They have very good food. Although it's a raw fish meal, and so for North Americans, we're the most skeptical. Europeans have no trouble with this. But I discovered with our guests, they were a little skeptical of what raw fish was like. Very good. Everyone participates. Everyone has an opportunity to share if they wish. This young gal is reading the scriptures for a Sunday. This is the passing of the peace, the day of the dedication. Peruvians, as probably are all Latins, are very touchy people. I have been joking because my two congregations I served were founded by Norwegians. So I always note that these are not Norwegians. I'm closing with just two slides. This one is a reminder to me of the cross with a kind of a question in terms of the needs and reality of Latin America. How does this relate? Is this a sunrise or a sunset? The Peruvians are very hopeful people, that they're in the midst of a sunrise. And I see that in the faces of their children, which for us was a real motivation. Lots of affirmation as we receive love and receive lots of attention. And I arrived for Sunday school, every young girl came and gave me a kiss. Every boy came and shook my hand. And that was considered good manners. I've been a little affection starved since I've returned to the States, but it's been for us an important experience and one we want to continue some contact with. I think that should be it. Okay. Oops. Where is that? Now, I did lots of talking. The disadvantage of slides is we get all focused in one area and we don't focus on each other. For this reason, we planned some other kinds of topics we felt could lend themselves more to discussion. And for us, that's good because we've heard ourselves. We would like to be in relationship with people. One of the ones we'll have Wednesday is on the debt, and it begins with a children's story so that we can get a little deeper into the economics. Not that we're great resources for economics, but we've been living there and experiencing that, and so have done our best to learn. Then on Thursday, maybe it is, I want to talk in more detail about an option for the poor, because I believe that is what we've been asked to do in Peru, and I think we have a lot to learn from that, because we are non-poor. I think it's difficult at times for our role as non-poor to relate to the poor. And many have tried their best to become poor. Well, how could I become poor? I could always return to the States. My kids were in a school and I had a car. So that we live with a variety of ambiguities that I think are somewhat related to ministry in the States as well. If we make an option to work with marginalized people, The Christian Century, a very well-known magazine, came out, I believe, in their January issue and said, most seminary graduates today want to be in the suburbs. So we are facing some decision-making in our own country, too, how we relate to marginalized people. And in fact, of course, for pastors in that case, could mean how does that relate to your salary? And the Seventh-day Adventists have answered that. The Lutheran Church in New Zealand has made some answers or statements about that. And I think that's an important one for us to consider. How can we sort of equalize salaries so that that doesn't become a barrier to doing ministry? Okay, that's some of the things I think we can talk about when we talk about the option for the poor. And then on Saturday, Consuelo, who you saw the picture of, it just bugged me to do a Bible study on Job. Well, my ministry was not to be their pastor, but to be present with them, often as a learner. And I said, well, we had started a Bible study just on the Sunday lessons. And I said, finally, well, okay, we'll do a Bible study on Job. What became such a powerful experience of the Peruvian reality as we studied Job that I would like to offer some study around that on Saturday. Okay. Now, maybe it's a good time to... Would you like to respond to some things, Linda, or let some other people redefine some questions maybe you have here? Okay. See, my questions are different than yours, and that's why I needed some of your questions today. My questions are sometimes, do foreigners make a difference? Kind of asking the question of the role of foreigners. Certainly one that has been asked in the Catholic churches, they have struggled sometimes. Peru has over 70% of its Catholic religious workers are non-Peruvian. 500 years after the conquest, that's a shocking statement that the faith, you might say, has not caught on to the leadership. But it is a Catholic country, and we worked in a country where people have a faith. They do believe. They maybe don't always express that in the same way we do. They have their traditions. For example, one of the congregations we work with in Lima, we worked with three, and I was asked once to do a funeral, I thought. So as I went there to do that and try to discover, I went early so I'd discover what I was being asked to do, learned that the man had died several years before. But it was the anniversary of his death. And so, of course, we would have a service, and his whole family and his relatives, everybody was there to remember that, with a family dinner afterwards. And I like that. But that comes out of their culture. It's not something we can take from there and bring up here and, you know, start necessarily. But it was part of the church I felt was a good part of being able to share in that. Okay. I don't know if I want to get into all the religious questions. Okay, go ahead then. Most of the people we worked with had not come out of Roman Catholic background, but lived in it. And there's a difference. They maybe were baptized Roman Catholic, or their children were still related to that. My kids were in a British school, and they received instruction in the Christian faith from a Catholic point of view. We could have taken them out of that if we chose to. It used to be the official religion of Peru. It no longer is. But it's the culture, and so the kids in our Sunday school, as part of going to school, which would have helped happened even for my own kids, are prepared for Holy Communion in school, in the public school, if you will. When you saw a picture of a shanty town, part of the land in the shanty town was saved for a Catholic church. It's that part of the culture, so that to be in that culture is somewhat to be Catholic, but some of them had been involved in other churches too. Some of the labels we have here don't fit in a country like Peru. We, in fact, were Lutherans. Well, I understood that there'd be a problem. I'm from California. We spell Lutheran seven different ways at least. The people in the Midwest, I found it was a little bit different for them, because if they'd come from Minnesota, they have been immersed in Lutheranism. And that kind of identity was kind of with their birthright, you might say. But in Peru, I found among our people a desire to know what is Lutheran. Missionaries had been there for 25 years with the former LCA, but still people were being asked by their family and friends, well, what's Lutheran? Because all non-Catholics are considered evangelicals. And included in that are Mormons. And so if you look like me, there's a good chance, which they did, they assumed I was a Mormon, even if I didn't wear a tie, because I come from the United States, and while we had trouble getting 12 visas, the Mormons had 500 visas. So there is some of those contextual things that, that's why I stopped before I got to realizing, how do you say a little bit? And I looked at my watch and said, well, we got about 10 minutes and I want to get on a couple other topics here. I'm not sure how much we can get into that. But one example, when we started our study of Job, we never got into it right away. We had one marvelous session and we finally were reading the first chapter of Job and realized a bunch of the women had never apparently opened a Bible before. There's a cultural difference for me, right? I kind of, when I realized that, to my chagrin, you know, I've read about that kind of stuff, but I'd forgotten it at that moment because I'd gotten to know these people for a year before we even had a Bible study. And so we did a lot of backtracking and still we're doing that when we left, of just how do we approach the Bible. The Catholics have an open Bible in Latin America, and part of what they celebrate in liberation theology is a chance for people to have a Bible and people to read, and to the communion of saints, if you will, is more real. It's not just the priest who knows everything. We still fight against that in the churches. Some of our people would say, well, you're educated in the United States, you know better. Well, I don't necessarily know better because I'm from the United States. And the people who know better are the ones who are there, who are living that. And to try to affirm that in them. And to go with them to offices, for example, trying to make connections with them, with organizations that could help their soup kitchen. Discovered sometimes they felt inadequate to go into an office and talk to an educated person, you know, somebody in a nice dress, about their needs. But they're very capable. And usually they push Consuelo in first, and she was a sharp gal because she was saying, hey, I'm only going to be around here for a few more years, ladies. Somebody else has got to pick up. You're able to do it. So it's affirming that. And that becomes a holistic part of the church, something that I enjoyed. And certainly don't know in a brief way how to respond to the fact that the church, if we are see ourselves as part of a kingdom of God, how we live that. Do we just hang out in one little building and read the Bible together, or does it encompass every part of our life? And I found much more freedom in Peru to live that because the people came and had something in common. Their own poverty brought them together. And women do not cook in a group because they want to. They don't say, hey, this is fun, all cooking together. No, they do that because they have to. And so there are times that it's very difficult to do that. And the end of the month's the worst time because they're totally out of money by then. And so sometimes they don't come to get their food thinking that they wouldn't have to pay, which they didn't. And then the soup kitchen would collapse for a few days, broke, because you can't loan too much if you're poor. Okay, I'd like to get over to, oh my goodness, let me do the rich-poor gap and then see if we can do something on, oh my, we got terrorists and everything here. How I had it in my mind was we could do the economy and the politics and the cocaine and the terrorism and the church, because those are the issues. And if you see this country, which still has a very rich sector, become rich off of the resources that are natural resources of Peru and not off of their hard work, you have a very, very rich sector. We didn't get to work with them too much. Then you have 95% of the country is what we're told make less than $200 a month. That's 95% making less than $200. Okay, well, the majority of those people make less than $25 a month. How do we relate to that? It's just incredible. Sometimes we'd stuff our pockets full of money in the morning going out wondering how much, you know, we're going to need for the day. Sometimes it was real cheap for a North American. Other times it seemed to be more expensive because of the inflationary movements. That rich-poor gap is what feeds terrorism. The people know it. Some years ago, 1980, I believe it was, the Sendero Luminoso, which means a shining path, first made its movement into the arena or politics of Peru. And what it has done, that I understand that has worked so well for it as a terrorist group, whatever terrorist means, because many times freedom fighters are the same words, you know, being used for terrorists, so we have to kind of put a parenthesis around that. They have chosen a very hardline approach to change Peru, to destroy the rich-poor gap. I found that as much as I would like to make opinions on terrorism, that it was better for me not to. It was not my country, and I felt it was better to be a listener in some of these areas, to hear what's going on in the people. Well, this particular group, Sendero Luminoso, said they're going to take over the country, and they published their newspaper, and when we left Peru, you could still buy it. Now, that's an amazing kind of freedom, to be able to publish a newspaper that's calling for the overthrow of the government. They do have a wider concept of democracy than we do. It's much more participatory. It allows for the right wing to have their newspapers, the left wing to have theirs. You have to buy several papers. I often did just to try to get a glimpse of what might be the news. Sendero connected with in Ayacucho, which is a state. I don't have any maps like that. It's a section of the Sierras. We're talking 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 feet. In a department of Ayacucho, which was one of the most difficult departments for the Incas to control. Incas ran from Ecuador all the way down to Chile and to parts of Argentina and built their roads and have been called the Romans of the New World. Any case, they connected with a consciousness or an unconsciousness, I'm not sure which is the phrase, that has to do with anyone imposing their will on these people. Marvelous artisanians come out of this area of Ayacucho. And these people have been fiercely independent. And then, anyways, in this Quechua mind, that's the language they speak, is Quechua. It just recently, or at least in the last 20 years, I believe, became an official language of Peru. The majority of the people had spoken Quechua, but Spanish was the legal language. You see, that's what kept the rich-poor gap going, so that the Spanish could control it. But they had a dictator, Velasco, who also spoke Quechua, and under that military dictatorship, he got through the right for people to speak Quechua to vote. Well, guess what they don't do in Peru? Just to sidestep for a moment. They don't teach Quechua. So people speak Quechua. The Wycliffe Bible translators translate the Bible into Quechua, but the people don't read Quechua. So that the ones who read Quechua Bibles, I discovered, were all missionaries from other countries who were taught to read Quechua. But that's that is the complex nature of this country. So that as Sendero has made now its plan to overthrow the government, it wants to take over an area called Huancayo, which is one of the areas of food production in Peru. And also to the north and south, it has made some inroads. But often for us that meant we lived with blackouts, as they would cut the electricity off to Lima by blowing up the towers, so that every now and then you'd have 3-4 days without any lights. And our water was off of a pump, so that meant without water. So it was experienced by all of us, the presence of this group that grew and grew and has grown quite fast. Now, what's being happened just recently in the last year, which is a new thing, is because of the drug trafficking in this one valley in the north of Peru, you have money flowing in from Colombia. Understand that Peru grows coca but does not apparently produce hardly any cocaine. Coca is a leaf that the people have chewing for years. As in other parts of the world, people will chew leaves, or they'll have leaves that they smoke, like in tobacco and so forth. These people would chew it, and it helped with the cold and the hunger in the altitudes. And so many of the people live from 9,000 feet up to 14,000 feet. So that was really where that leaf was used. And in Lima, there are still people who like to chew it. If you go as a tourist, or you have gone as a tourist to Peru, you'll be given, when you arrive in Cusco, a cup of coca tea. It's like an aspirin. It helps you relax and adjust to the altitude. A German scientist discovered how to make cocaine from this leaf. So those leaves are taken out into Colombia, where they're processed and exported around the world. That money then returns in that way, and somehow, as you know, it's connected with Panama and all. And that money enters back into Peru. Well, this Maoist organization, which is one of the ways that Sendero is referred to, apparently receives no help from any other government in the world. It's on its own. It's a Peruvian expression of their understanding of freedom for all. They are protecting the farmers who grow the coca from the police, who ask for protection money so that they can supplement their income. You understand, when the police are making, say, $25 a month, that they're more apt to want bribes on the road and so forth to help supplement. You know, my wife, she would really like a new dress. And you were driving a little fast, or you went through that light or whatever. And so they do the same thing with the peasant farmers. And the Sendero group is committed to protecting the farmers. And so you'll hear good about that organization from the farmers. Now, you won't hear good in the newspapers, because Sendero believes in killing lots of people. It goes into a community and says, okay, what's wrong with your town? People tell them, okay, mayor, over here, we're going to shoot you, mayor, and we'll shoot a couple of you. And then after them, the military comes in and says, there's some Sendero sympathizers here. We want you out in town. We'll put a bag over your head and we'll kill you too. So the people are often caught in the middle. And that is what makes this rich-poor gap, and I'm simplifying it, but it is so complex, because it's like the middle class is a bridge. Well, some of you probably could add more to that, but because there's such a difference and the majority are poor, the people with money have power, and they're going to keep their power, right? And the poor don't have power. And so the poor find that a group like Sendero offers them power for change. They don't have to see their children starving to death. Or as the women who've been interviewed who work in coca fields will say, if I produce this coca leaf, which is sold in your country as a narcotic, I can buy shoes for my children. I can buy clothes, and I can buy some better food besides potatoes. But if I sell it for chewing, I don't make anything. So it's simplified, but very difficult situation. Okay, I've just hit on those briefly. There is another group of terrorists that are quite active in Lima, and then there's another group also in Peru. But the Sendero has become the strongest group, and in fact has even had fights with the other terrorist groups. And the military has to be included, because the military now seem to have, at least with the police, a right-wing terrorist squad. So that we have, from a right-wing side, people being accused of whatever crime and being murdered by the police. They seem to use silencers, so that's how the news figures out who's doing what, if they don't take credit. People like to take credit for their murders. I know we reached the end of our time here, and I'm not sure I've answered... Where am I? Can't even see it. Answered everything with the economy, but last year Peru was only competing with Nicaragua for the worst economy in the world. And with that sort of economy and chaos, the people are apt to be, you know, wanting handouts. And as they make their debt payments, for example, they're so far behind they can't keep up with the interest. It's just accumulating. So I think in the last 3 years, under a democracy, the foreign debt of Peru has increased $2 billion, and that's just from the interest. So that the people who borrowed money and are no longer in power got their money. Some of the military are wealthy people in Peru. It gives you quite a perspective on our own system that we have. But the one question I haven't really got to say too much about is the North American influence. Did have a chance to go to the U.S. Embassy and meet with some people. We do have a lot of influence in Peru. Earlier this year, the Peruvian military wanted to take over the government of Alan Garcia. He tried to leave the country. In fact, they stopped him on an airplane. They went to the U.S. Embassy and they said, "We'd like to take over. Would you recognize us?" And the U.S. Embassy said, "No, we're not going to recognize you at this time." And so they backed off. That just little bit of word from the ambassador is that powerful to help shape the lives of many people in Peru. Well, I thought it was a good thing that we kept out. Because once you have the military control, the whole popular movement of people with labor organizations and teachers and all those unions are out. They become illegal. So as long as we have that democracy, as unstable as it is, the people have their right to participate. Well, thank you very much for coming.